Welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Joe Rexrode from The Athletic taking you through this Monday morning here in Nashville, Tennessee. And we're pleased to be joined by Bill Bender of Sporting News. And we've kind of been talking about, you know, the things we've been missing out on in sports over the past week or so. And the NCAA tournament, I think, is chief among those. Bill Bender wrote a really interesting piece for the Sporting News about the kind of the biggest upsets in the NCAA tournament since 1984. Bill, thanks for coming on this morning and joining us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, Marquise didn't tell me I had to talk to Joe. I mean, I wouldn't have came on otherwise. Ah. No, it's great to talk to you guys.
Little social distancing bonus for you, Bill.
That's awesome. I hope you guys are doing well. So I honestly don't know what to talk about, so you guys just fire away and let me know.
Well, Bill, let's start there. I know you put together this list, kind of the biggest upsets in the NCAA tournament. Number one, how much fun was that for you to be able to put together and kind of go back and look at some of the upsets throughout the history of the NCAA tournament? And number two, I guess how much of a sobering reminder is that of what we're missing out on right now?
I guess that's the start. I thought CBS did a good job this weekend of putting on some games that we could all relate to. Like, for example, my 9-year-old or 8-year-old son, soon to be 9, got to see the Leitner Kentucky game, and we kind of watched that one in the entirety, and you kind of appreciate it a little more. And that's the bad part about that list is we didn't get to add to it. Another, like, shocking first-round upset. I mean, there have been so many through the years. I mean, obviously, UMBC Virginia takes the top spot, but I was really hoping we could add a couple more this year.
Well, you also you've got some really cool things here on the NCAA tournament. The clutch shots, Bill. That's as much as upsets are obviously a huge part of this tournament, but like the buzzer beaters also, whether it's an upset or not, those are the moments that I still remember the most, and I thought it was really interesting to rank the very top of that list. I went through it. I was like, okay, I covered 2018 and two. Two was, of course, Nova UNC. I think you could make a case for Lorenzo Charles, but you just mentioned the game that was on. Hopefully, if people were home, they were watching it. I think I saw you had video of your kid watching this, did you not?
Yeah.
Yeah. The Leitner shot. I mean, it's hard to beat that one.
Well, and I explained to Grant, too, that Leitner went 10-10 and 10-10 in that game and just finished it off with a perfect shot. I didn't know you were at the Villanova-North Carolina game. That had to have been awesome to cover. And just from the standpoint of I guess I would ask you that back, Joe, is when the shot went up, were you like, okay, that's in, like as soon as it left? That's how I felt watching it on TV.
Yeah, and, well, but the shot, of course, the shot that preceded it was the crazier shot, right? And actually, so we have, Charles Robinson on here sometimes, my buddy who lives in Houston. He actually took video of the North Carolina shot and me, like, putting my hands on my head. I mean, a lot of people have made fun of me about this many times. Like, they're just shocked. Like, how the heck did that go in shot? And then, but I agree with you. You kind of, like, the way that that play set up, like, because it was just in rhythm and it was perfect. You're like, there is no way that's not going in. And, of course, right. It did. So, but when you combine those two back-to-back, those are incredible. You also had two on there that, to me, I'll never forget as a fan watching March Madness. That was in 1990 in, I think, New Jersey. For people who remember this, back-to-back games, one, Tate George beats Clemson on, like, a baseline turnaround at the buzzer. But then Leitner does it to UConn 2 days later. So it's Sweet 16 and Elite Eight, same building, and those both were pretty prominent on your list. And I thought that was dead on because that was just an incredible – just, one building to see two shots like that.
Yeah, and then I think we all grew up, I'm going to assume Robbie's about our same age too, where the one that we always reenacted in the gym in junior high and high school was the Bryce Drew one, where the timing of that play, again, like when that went up, you're thinking, well, it's got a shot. And literally the day that we put this list out, I caught myself kind of going through all of these buzzer beaters and then rewatching them. Even the one with James Forrest on the wing for Georgia Tech. And that's, again, I think you're right in that, yeah, I like the upsets too. I don't mind those. But there's nothing quite like that buzzer beater, because those are the shots you remember basically where you were every time one of them happens. Even if it's – I can't remember the kid's name, but the Western Kentucky one sticks out to me too.
Bill Bender on the line with us from Sporting News. And, Bill, I saw you tweet about this yesterday as well, and it got me kind of thinking. The Kentucky-Duke regional game from 92, where would you rank that in terms of college basketball all-time games for you personally?
Oh, it's the best game. I think it might be the best game across all of sports. It has that single sporting event. It would be on my short list. And the other ones on that list would probably be Game 7, Cubs and Indians, because I was actually at that one, and it ended the wrong way, but that's okay. it had the wrong ending, but it was, you know, in terms of spectacle and all those things. And, you know, the college football games we've done, that's a hard one. I still think, you know, Texas USC is probably on that list as well. And then I'm trying to think, you guys would disagree. I think the greatest Super Bowl of all time is 49ers-Bengals. When Montana took them down and won. Now, I know there's been some pretty good ones since, but I still think that's the standard. Even though if you want to say Brady coming back from 28-3, that's fine too.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I think that's a tough one. I don't have an absolute no, this is the best Super Bowl ever. I will say that game was also great because we were in the era of so many bad games then. That was, you know, it was just blowout after blowout. And the next year, I think the 49ers beat the Broncos like 100-3, right? So to have that one sandwich in all the garbage games, I would that to me made it even better because we so badly needed one. And by the way, Robbie, you're going to have to tell Bill how old you are. I mean, no, unfortunately, Bill, Robbie is not in our age bracket.
Bill, I was
just
born in 1992.
Seasoned.
Is he in the one before or after us?
I was born in 1992, but the good news is both you and Joe, I guarantee, have more hair than I do. So that part should be very encouraging for you both.
So, yeah, well, I made this mistake on the radio a couple weeks ago. I said that, you know, to somebody, and the guy said, I said, yeah, we're both in our 40s, right? And he's like, I'm 33, and I'm like, well, now what do I do here? because I've not only insulted your Twitter avatar, but I've insulted you, so I've got to do that. But no, I do, and, you know, I just think Joe and I are lucky in terms of if you grew up around then. Like, the 90s basketball era sticks out to me more than anything because, I mean, you spilled from those great Dukes teams to the Fab Five. You started the decade with UNLV. And you ended it with Michigan State winning in 2000. And that to me is the golden age of college basketball in a lot of ways. Because guys were staying, too. The Arkansas guy stayed. Corliss stayed for 3 years. He probably could have gone to the NBA after his first 5 games. And that's what I miss about college basketball, too, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, whether you like Duke or not, you know, Grant Hill, 4-year player. I mean, imagine that now. I mean, it's comical, you know. And, you know, Leitner as well, although his NBA career wasn't great. But, yeah, you're right. That was until we got to about, you know, Kevin Garnett goes straight to the NBA, and that's kind of a new wave. And more guys were just, you know, either staying briefly or not going. There were a lot more teens with seniors who were NBA players then.
Yeah. And you know, even as you got into the next decade, it was fine. But there were so many things in this tournament particular that I've thought about over the last couple of weeks. You know, I don't know if Robbie knows, Joe knows, I'm based in Ohio. I wanted to see Dayton make a run with Obi Toppin.
Oh. Yeah.
I wanted to see Michigan State make a run with Cassius Winston and his career and how that kind of comes full circle with Sparty point guards. You know, I wanted to see if Kansas could kind of win in the face of the NCAA, if you will, you know, and just go through that. And what are they going to do with them being under investigation? And we got robbed of that in a lot of ways. And don't get me wrong, I know why, and it was the right call. And we're in, I don't know how it is down there in Tennessee. We are in shelter in place in Ohio. So yeah, it's a serious situation, but it's okay to miss what we missed.
Bill, last thing for you here as we wrap up here. Obviously, this is a question that nobody will ever be able to answer fully, But with the NCAA tournament being kind of robbed from us this year, as you said there, who do you think would have been the favorite to win and why?
I really think those two teams I mentioned would have been interesting in terms of Dayton with their star power, with Toppin and Crutcher. And I think America might have rallied around them a little bit once they got to the Sweet 16.
Yeah.
At Michigan State, you can't go wrong. They would have probably been in my Final Four. And then, you know, I have a hard time getting off the way Kentucky was playing throughout the year. I mean, those would have been my three favorites to kind of get to the Final Four and maybe go from there. And then you always leave room for a sleeper, such as, well, I don't know that San Diego State and Gonzaga were sleepers. I'll believe it when I see it when they cut them down. And I think the next step for all of us, like I said, not to be a PSA or anything, but I'm a little worried about football season, honestly, if this thing continues to go on.
Yeah, we were actually just talking about that. Like, there's so much uncertainty going on right now that we've all just kind of assumed from the start that football season won't be affected and we'll have everything figured out by then. But I think, Bill, one of the crazy things right now is we simply don't know how this is going to play out, and that just kind of illustrates how serious it is.
Exactly. Well, as I told Marquise, anytime you guys need to talk, we can talk about it. I know we all have to fill out content and airwaves here. I wrote about cherry spitting last week. So anytime you guys want to come on and talk, I'd be happy to, and I hope you guys be well down there.
Hey, Bill, thanks so much for joining us, man. We appreciate it.
Hey, take care.
Good talking to you, Bill.
Absolutely. Bill Bender from Sporting News has been our guest here on Morning Drive. When we come back, what are some of the more memorable NCAA tournament games that stick out in our minds? That's next. This is Morning Drive with Robbie Stanley and Joe Rexroad here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside the great and talented Joe Rexroad from The Athletic, taking you through this Monday morning here in Nashville, Tennessee. And Joe, we were talking to Bill Bender of Sporting News in the last segment, kind of reliving some of the most memorable NCAA tournament games that we've seen in the last 30, 40 years or so. And, Joe, I'll be honest with you, the one that sticks out to me the most, I remember exactly where I was that Villanova-North Carolina game. Just the way that it ended, obviously the stakes being as high as they were in the national championship game, it was just an incredible scene there to watch that final shot go in. And like Bill said, it was one of those things that as soon as the ball was released, you kind of had a good feeling that it was going in just based off the trajectory of the shot. And certainly you talk about a memorable way to end the game, that's about as good as it gets in my mind.
Yeah, that's an all-timer. And you know, you don't have too many that, you know, championship games that end like that, you know, so that's always going to be there, you know. And so much of this depends on, you know, like your perspective at the time too, you know, you and Marquise,
right.
You know, Bill, I should have asked Bill what his specific, you know, memory was of this, but the first time I was allowed to stay up was the 1983 championship game. Now, a game that seriously made me fall in love with sports was Houston against Louisville, 1983, Final Four. If you haven't seen it, look it up on YouTube. It is the most incredible display of dunking that's ever happened in a college basketball game, and it came in the Final Four. I mean, Clyde Drexler, Michael Young, Benny Anders, Hakeem Olajuwon, Rodney McRae. It was incredible. And this was a Final Four game. So, I mean, so then you think Houston is going to kill NC State. I mean, everybody did. Houston was clearly the most talented team in the country. NC State was out of nowhere in the Final Four. So being able to stay up, and, I mean, everybody's seen this, right? Everybody's at least seen the highlight of Derek Wittenberg throwing up a prayer and Lorenzo Charles dunking it at the buzzer, Jim Valvano running around. That whole thing. Seeing that live, like, that's an all-time sports moment for me. So that's one. Also, Robbie, this works well with me promoting The Athletic, as I know Adam Vingan wants me to do. We have a 90-day free trial.
Yeah, you got to step your game up there.
That's right. We got a 90-day free trial going on, so you can 90 days free, check everything out. But a lot of us are working on the best NCAA game I've ever seen, or that, you know, that I've covered. A lot of us who've covered college basketball for a while. So I'm actually in the process of putting that together. And there are a lot of choices, including Tennessee Purdue from a year ago, by the way. Unbelievable game. Tennessee Loyola from 2 years ago. On the Tennessee front, an Elite Eight game, Tennessee-Michigan State from 2010. Those were three that were contenders for me, though they were not the winner.
Yeah, Tennessee fans are not going to like you for bringing that up. Those are three very painful memories for Vols fans there. Joe, I feel like I've missed out on, like, you know, Bill was talking in the last segment about, like, the golden era of college basketball being in the 90s. And obviously I was born in 92, so I was a child when all this was going on. I feel like I've missed out on some really impressive college basketball. And the Kentucky-Duke game from 92, everybody keeps telling me about that game and just how awesome it was. What do you remember specifically from that game between Kentucky and Duke in 92?
Yeah, and that was, I mean, I'm sure some people saw that because they replayed that. CBS replayed that the other day. The crazy thing about that one, Robbie, and it's that and then the year before it, okay? So that game, you know, Kentucky was coming back from, like, probation, and they had bottomed out, and so Rick Pitino, you know, it had them coming quickly, of course. I mean, you know, shoot, the next year they had Jamal Mashburn, and they, you know, he quickly got them turned around. But that was
still... Isn't it interesting how Rick Pitino was, like, the rescuer of probation then, and now where Rick Pitino is now? I digress.
Continue. Yes, yeah, exactly, yes. And, you know, Rick Pitino has his methods. But that was the, like, plucky underdog Kentucky team. Like, the whole country was rooting for Kentucky, you know, as the lovable underdog. And Duke was big, mighty, mean Duke. But the crazy thing is, like, just a year earlier, it was the opposite of that with Duke playing UNLV, which also is one of the greatest games I've ever seen. I mean, no doubt. Duke-UNLV in the 1991 Final Four. UNLV was the defending national champ, was unbeaten, and had destroyed Duke by 30 the previous year in the title game. And, you know, for people who don't remember, you know, Krzyzewski had the tag on him that he couldn't win the big one at that point. He had not won a championship. Yeah. He'd been to the Final Four several times, but they had failed, you know, in 86 the title game, but in 87 or in 88, that was Kansas, Oklahoma. 89, they lost to Seton Hall. Like, he couldn't win the big one. Then they got destroyed by UNLV. So it was like, oh, go Duke. We love you, Duke, you lovable Blue Devils. And then the next year, they're the defending champ with Leitner, and Leitner's stomping on guys and all that stuff. And so it was one of those things where I think for a lot of the country, it was an incredible finish. And anyone who watched that game knew, like, that's one of the best games ever. And I think Bill's right, like, one of the best sports games ever. Just take it out of college basketball. But also, I know for me, I was like, oh, no. Leitner, again, can't he miss one shot? I mean, you had to hate. That's a great 30 for 30 if you've never seen it. You know, whatever it is, like, why I hate Christian Leitner.
Oh, I hate Christian Leitner. It came on this weekend, actually.
Yeah,
that's a great 30 for 30, and I hated him so much. Of all the hateable Duke players, Leitner, man, I mean, I hope Vingan is listening. I'd love to know where Vingan has Leitner on his all-time favorite. I know he was like 3 years old when that game happened, but if you weren't a Duke fan, a true blue Duke fan, you hated Christian Leitner.
I think Vingan literally has like a Leitner jersey. I think that's a part of his clothing repertoire.
Does he really? I mean, I wouldn't be surprised at all.
I don't think I'm making this up. I think that's a real thing with Adam Vingan. Munson, what is your most memorable NCAA tournament game?
A lot of it's not games. Like, obviously, the Baylor-Georgia State game comes to mind, where you got R.J. Hampton hitting that three, and then all of a sudden his dad falls out of the chair. That's fun stuff. You know, obviously, Butler's run in the tournament, with the first game being against Duke, and you had, you know, Gordon Hayward and Shelvin Mack and that team, you know, and then the following year they had to go against Kemba Walker had one of the most memorable seasons to me, especially in that Big East game where the crossover and the game-winning shot. So, like, it's mostly for me players. Like, I remember a lot of, like, watching players, like watching these guys actually play, and I was excited to see Ja Morant in the playoff or in the tournament as well last year, because I got to watch him play live, and I'm like, ooh, this guy's going to make some noise in the tournament.
He was so great in that first game.
Yeah, so great in the first game, but I knew it was going to come to an end because he didn't have the team around him to really build a – it wasn't like Kemba. Like Kemba had, like, some guys around him, but John Morant didn't have a lot to work with. And so I remember mostly just players and their tournament runs, if anything.
It's funny because...
So I'll tell you...
Go ahead, man.
I'll tell you a couple that stand out to me, like, locally. You know, obviously Belmont, Duke, and we talked about, you know, Belmont almost got Duke. I think it was back in 08. But one that you'll be really familiar with, MTSU, a 90-81 win against the Michigan State Spartans. That was probably the most invested, because I went to MTSU. That's probably the most invested I've been in one of these early round games where it upsets on the loose. Like, you know, you find yourself, like, for instance, like the UMBC Virginia stuff. Like, I was rooting for UMBC to win that game, but it was like you're not like emotionally invested in it. That MTSU Michigan State game was awesome to watch.
Yeah, that's also on the list of runners up for me and most memorable, because I mean, at the time, and I think clearly MTSU was underseeded, and I think, you know, I think Giddy Potts had missed some time. They lost like four straight with them. That was not a 15. I mean, clearly, right?
Yeah.
I mean the next year they go and beat Minnesota in the tournament. I think they won 31 games the next year. That was like a 12 seed as a 15. But at the very on that moment, it was like, well, this is like Michigan State. Everybody thought was going to be a 1. They were a 2, and this is a 15. So it's as close to a 16 beating a 1 as the tournament had seen. So on that day, I was like, this is maybe the biggest upset in tournament history. I think as time went on, you're like, well, that was a really good MTSU team. But no, incredible memory. And for me, guys, I had just been hired to be the columnist at the Tennessean. And so basically my boss at the time, Dave Ammenhauser, was like, well, cover Michigan State. They'll probably go to the Final Four. And then, you know, then you can come here and start. So obviously that day I got a text from Mike Anastasi, the editor of the Tennessean, saying, hey, can you write a front page column on the Blue Raiders? And I'm like, well, if you can wait a while, because I got to wrap up like the most disastrous loss on my beat in history. So that I'll never forget that. And I stayed in St. Louis with the Blue Raiders. And it's too bad for that team, by the way, that Syracuse was the second round opponent. I think that was a Sweet 16 caliber MTSU team. But that Syracuse zone on a one-day prep is a problem, and that's exactly how it turned out.
Yeah, it was just one of the more crazy things. And Belmont, that Belmont-Duke game, they were so close in that game.
Oh, man. The whole country was a Belmont Bruin fan right then.
They were America's darling team, and they were so close to pulling it off. And I was actually in school watching that game illegally. I was supposed to be in class, and I would sneak out and watch games with a PE teacher on TV, but it was awesome. I thought they had them.
So wait, so you were in high school then?
I was.
All right. It's just little doses of remembering how old you are.
Yes.
Thank you,
little
Robbie.
Little doses of Robbie's youth that I'm going to continually toss in here as we move forward. When we come back, how did the Tampa Bay Buccaneers get Tom Brady to come to Tampa Bay? And did the interview go quite like they thought it would? I think you'll find the answer to that to be very interesting. That's next. This is Morning Drive with Robbie Stanley and Joe Rexroad here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Joe Rexroad from The Athletic. And Joe, we've been talking for the last week about Tom Brady's decision to join the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And Rick Stroud of the Tampa Bay Times came out with an article yesterday kind of detailing the meeting between Brady and the Buccaneers. And it was really interesting. It was about a 90-minute phone conversation where apparently, like, Brady knew everything about Bruce Arians' offense. He could recite by position the list of the offensive weapons that they had. And really, the money was the last thing to come up in the conversation between Tom Brady and the Buccaneers. And you know how you usually, you know, you feel like if somebody of Tom Brady's ilk, you get to the end of the conversation and he's going to ask, hey, can I have control over this? Can I be able to run and have final say in the offense? Well, Brady didn't say anything about that. Really, the only thing he asked for at the end of the phone call, according to Rick Stroud, was he wanted the phone numbers of each of his new teammates, which is just incredible to think about. So it basically was an interview process that, you know, the Bucs thought they were going to be able to make their pitch to Brady, and it basically turned into Brady just grilling them for like 90 minutes on things that he wanted to know about, things he was curious about with the personnel there. Just really fascinating stuff.
Right, and I thought it was also interesting, not surprising, but, you know, the fact that he knew everything about the Bruce Arians offense, was asking specific, you know, details about certain things. And interesting too, you know, we asked about, you know, Mike Evans and Chris Godwin, are they good guys? You know,
yeah.
And Jason Leggett assures him the best. You know, the funny thing is going through this process, Robbie, I never thought like money was number one, but I also did think because Tom Brady has sacrificed some financially for the Patriots over the years that maybe it would kind of be trying to go two for one, like, you know, huge payday along with whatever the number one thing you knew was going to be the best opportunity for him to get to a Super Bowl in his mind because it's just he's not playing anymore to just compile stats or make more money. He doesn't need to make any more money. But I did think that maybe, you know, it was like, you know, let's also see money is also an indication of, you know, of I mean it's what it says sometimes, not just the money itself. But clearly, I mean, based on this account of the discussion, it didn't come up, you know, and so I guess that shouldn't be that surprising. I mean, it's about Brady is trying to, you know, I don't know if it's necessarily at the expense of Belichick, but certainly his own legacy, he desperately wants to add to it and win another one. And it's a fascinating situation to think of those two guys, Arians and Light, basically saying to themselves, wow, this is really happening at the end of this phone call. Like even, you know, at that point, so much speculation, but they didn't know until this phone call happened.
Yeah, and to your point, Joe, like all the chatter out of New England when it came to Tom Brady was, you know, about not feeling appreciated, not feeling, you know, like he has been valued enough in terms of his credit that he deserves for what New England has been able to do. And I don't know about you, but when I associated that in terms of, you know, the lack of appreciation and all that stuff, I thought money. So I thought the next place he went, while it wouldn't be the most important thing, I thought, you know, you'd be talking about somewhere in the $30 million range, maybe $31, $32 million per season, and that was not the case. Now, he's got some incentives that can kick in on his contract, but I think $25 million guaranteed per season. So that number came in pretty significantly lower than I thought it would. It was just kind of interesting to read that article from the Tampa Bay Times in that, you know, it seemed like Brady, you know, from the outset was pretty interested in the Buccaneers, studied pretty much everything about him. And, you know, that 90-minute phone call, it seems like, was kind of like the final decision maker for Tom Brady. I'm sure he had some other things that he wanted to work out and maybe some other situations that he wanted to check out. But it seems like the interest between Brady, or at least from Brady's vantage point, has been there in Tampa Bay for a while.
Yeah, and even though, you know, Jason Light was just like with John Robinson, of course, they were, you know, good friends, worked in New England together. Of course, John Robinson was his number two in Tampa Bay before coming here. But he and, you know, Light and Brady did not have any sort of, you know, really relationship or anything like that.
Right.
So it really wasn't about that. They just happened to work in the same organization briefly. So, yeah, this was very much Brady interviewing them, and obviously they did well in the interview. And, you know, $25 million, nine in incentives, I think, and I don't think they're, like, lofty incentives. I mean, a lot of it is really just are you staying on the field
right. And
producing as expected. So, you know, if you look at it that way, it's about $29.5 million a year if – you know, if he's able to play and do as hoped, not huge, but again, I mean, it's a 43 and 44 year old player in those years. So, I mean, look, no, you can talk about the weapons, and people will forever when you talk about Brady's finish in New England, but he also was not playing as well, and so that reflects part of that pay as well. I mean, that's part of the deal. It's still pretty good for a 43-year-old guy to make that kind of money playing football.
Joe, and we were talking earlier in the show about, you know, Brian Hoyer signing with the Patriots and that kind of being a signal that maybe they are looking to make Jared Stidham the guy there in New England. Number one, how surprised are you by that? And also, like, you know, we played some comments last week about it seemingly like the Patriots just didn't actually think that Tom Brady at the end of the day was going to leave and somewhat are taken off guard by this. That just doesn't sound like something that would happen, Belichick. and the New England Patriots, who have pretty much prepared and planned for every conceivable situation over the course of the last 20 years. So I wonder, you know, if Jared Stidham, maybe he was their plan, their succession plan, all along over the course of the last year or so here.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question, and there's no doubt. Now, there's no doubt that there's been a lot of reporting coming out of Boston to the effect of a lot of people in that organization taken off guard and sort of, I don't want to say blowing off Brady, but sort of just not wanting to believe that he would really leave. Now, is that true of Belichick? I don't know. I think, you know, that could be true of a lot of people in the organization and still not be true of Belichick. I mean, that's a tougher one to, and I haven't seen anyone claim to know that or report that it was him that was taken off guard. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people there were surprised, and I don't know, maybe they think so much of Stidham that Belichick was comfortable with this all along and was like, okay, let's let the kid go. Man, that's one of those things. We've seen very little of him, obviously. Saw him in college, thought he was a good player. Sometimes it just doesn't. I did not watch Jared Stidham at Auburn and think, watch out NFL.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought he was a talented guy, a guy who was good enough to play in the league. It's hard to make that translation sometimes. You know, again, I mean, I watched Tom Brady up close when he was in college, and yeah, he was a good player. You know, he was a good player. He couldn't stay on the field his entire senior year because a freshman was splitting time with him. But there was nothing in that career that told anyone, oh, this guy's going to be one of the greatest to play football. And he was. So, hey, maybe Stidham is that guy. The signing of Hoyer definitely kind of reinforces the idea that that's where Belichick's going. To my dismay, because I wanted to see especially a Cam pickup and what that would have looked like in New England.
Yeah, I thought that would have been fascinating too. And, you know, the unfortunate part of this for Stidham, and look, you're an NFL quarterback and there's pressure that comes along with that regardless of the situation, but now you are following, you know, a living legend in Tom Brady in New England. And with that, you know, whether it's fair or unfair, there are going to be lofty expectations placed on Jared Stidham if indeed he is the guy the Patriots decide to go with moving forward. And I look at their weapons right now and I'm like, you know, is he really set up for success? Like, if Tom Brady, even though he is older and his skill set, I believe, has diminished a little bit, if he can't make that offense work with the weapons they have right now, like why would we expect, you know, Jared Stidham to come in and be able to do it any better?
Yeah, I mean, a guy like N'Keal Harry, I do think has a ton of talent. And, you know, he was hurt a lot of last year and, you know, then came in, but he wasn't ready. And that's a guy who could take a big step. You know, some of those guys could be better. But, yeah, I look at that team and I think it's a really good defensive team still and a pretty pedestrian offensive team with Brady. Is Stidham going to be some dynamic addition to give it new life? I mean, I think that's a stretch, but hey, we'll see. You know, Belichick, that's the thing. I just thought he's going to try to come up with the instant, you know, semi-gamble, high-risk, high-reward move to try to, you know, to try to compete with Brady from the other side of the league, and it doesn't look that way right now, and that's very disappointing.
Well, to that point, though, like we talk about Brady and like his motivation, you know, he's won 6 Super Bowls, but now he's away from Belichick. He's away from the Patriots. And we talk about his motivation to win outside of that system. How much motivation do we think is there for Bill Belichick to prove that, hey, you know, this is not just Tom Brady and the New England Patriots. I'm probably the biggest part of this equation.
I don't know. I think we like to think that way. You know, but I think there's more evidence that Brady feels that way than Belichick right now.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So, I mean, we know that. And by the way, this brings up a big argument I've had with Jared Stone and others before about the Seth Wickersham piece from a couple years ago. And Wickersham has a new piece that's really good about how this all went down, Wickersham has great sources in the organization and was right and quoted people who knew that the whole Garoppolo thing was a rift. I mean,
yeah.
It wasn't an irreconcilable difference, but it was a thing. I mean, to suggest otherwise or to say like this reporter just making stuff up was so dumb. And so, you know, I think from the Belichick side, we know at least that he had a certain plan for replacing Brady and probably wasn't comfortable getting into the mid-40s with Brady, you know, but how motivated is he? I mean, how long is he going to stick around? To me, if he's going with Stidham right now, that sounds more like a guy who's going to be around a while. I mean, it's almost the same kind of thing. Like, why do you want to be average if you're only going to take a short run at it? I mean, you know, he's 67. Maybe he's planning on a few more years and wants to build it back, you know, without thinking about a one-year fix, and figures he'll be around after Brady's retired.
Yeah, certainly going to be interesting to see how that situation in New England plays out. When we come back, Jameis Winston saying goodbye to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Who's more likely to have a comeback, him or Marcus Mariota? We'll get into that next. This is Morning Drive with Robbie Stanley and Joe Rexroad here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into Morning Drive here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley alongside Joe Rexroad from The Athletic. And you heard Peter King there talking about Jameis Winston and maybe the market that's out there for him in the NFL. And Joe, Winston is one of those really fascinating guys where you look at the numbers, and obviously the interceptions are the biggest part of it, and we'll get to that here in just a second. But the yards, I mean, you're playing with Mike Evans and Chris Godwin, so I get that. That's part of this discussion as well. But the talent, you can see. It's there. We saw it at Florida State. We saw that when Jameis Winston is on, he's a really, really good player, a unique player in the way that he's able to attack the game from a quarterback position. But the decision-making, some of the throws that he makes, the reads that he makes with the defense, you know, 30 interceptions, that's really hard to do in today's NFL. So because of that, you hear about maybe the market for Winston being ice cold. I think obviously a lot of teams are they see the talent, they see everything that he has, but they are terrified of those turnover numbers that also come with Jameis Winston.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously something that's going to end up costing him a lot of money for sure, and probably put him in a situation. I mean, it's funny, like Tannehill now is like the fairy tale story for
poster child, you know, of all quarterbacks.
Like Cinderella is like the princess story that everyone, you know, all the quarterbacks who are, you know, sort of thrown on the heap or want to be Ryan Tannehill now. You know, look what you can do. 1 year ago, Tannehill's got the Dolphins paying five of his $7 million here, and now he just signed for $4 million and $118 million. So, I mean, it looks like we just talked about New England. Now, that was one possibility. You know, you look around. Basically, you got four guys right now. You've got Winston. You've got Dalton. You've got Flacco, and you've got Cam. You know, those are the four guys who are, you know, guys who could be starters in the NFL, and it's like this game of musical chairs. It seems like if you're one of those guys, certainly an attractive place would be Jacksonville, because now it's only Gardner Minshew there. You know, you feel like you could go there and certainly have a chance to get on the field and prove yourself. We've talked about Pittsburgh too. You know, Pittsburgh is certainly a place that, Roethlisberger can't have a lot. He's 38. Anybody who saw his Twitter picture this weekend, he looks like he's about 71 with the, you know, Rip Van Winkle beard.
It was incredible.
Which, by the way, is not very responsible these days. There's other places where now Flacco's out, so, you could go to Denver. Something like that, but it looks like that's going to have to be something like that for Winston, who, again, tremendous talent. If he throws 20 picks last year instead of 30, you know, we might be talking about different stuff right now. Just 30 picks is
–
And the thing about it is Bruce Arians all year defended him, probably to a fault, but by the end of the year – you know, I think Arians even was like, okay, I don't know what to do, man. You know, like you could tell in some of Arians' comments late in the year, it was like, okay, I can't keep saying it's the receiver's fault every time he throws a pick.
Well, Joe, I mean, football is not the only sport that Jameis Winston is talented at. He played baseball at Florida State as well. What about him playing baseball in the future? Peter King talked about that. Here's what he had to say.
If no one is going to give him a chance to compete to be a starter, if he's going to be a guy who holds a clipboard, does he at least entertain the possibility of the Tim Tebow route? Jump on the bus, get on a single-A team, and try to play baseball. Why not now? If you're ever going to do it, now's the time to do it. And you're walking away from, what, $5, $6 million a year as a backup, something you don't want to do. You want to play. Do you think that this is the time for Jameis Winston to indulge his desire to play baseball?
Mike, I think that before I would do that, if I were him, and I think it's an interesting question. I have no idea what his mental frame of mind right now is. It wouldn't shock me, though. I'll never forget this. I talked to him coming out of the combine in 2015, and he told me at the time that he would love to be able in the offseason to spend a couple of months being a closer for somebody and, you know, or pitching somewhere. He throws 95. He might be the kind of guy with his sort of mental frame of mind. He's not an overly emotional guy. He might be the kind of guy who you could say, you know, we'd let him be a closer. But I think of that, and then I think of where he is right now, and he probably really wants to show people that the Bucks should have believed in me. This was year one and with Arians, and I'm going to be really good.
What do we make of that? The proposition of Jameis Winston going to play baseball, saying, you know what? Forget this football stuff. I'm done with it. I don't want to be a backup quarterback. I'm going to pursue my dream of becoming a professional baseball player.
I mean, I look at some of these picks, and I can't help but think of Nuke LaLoosh. And please tell me you guys get the Nuke LaLoosh reference.
Yes, yes.
Very good. I'm impressed, and I'm proud of you. Actually,
it's probably my favorite baseball movie of all time.
There you go. It's one of the best. One of the best sports movies ever. Bull Durham, everyone. In case you haven't seen it, Nuke LaLoosh, all kinds of talent, and then every once in a while, the mascot would take one in the head. So I don't know. A lot of guys throw 95. I mean, he throws 95. That's great. A lot of guys throw 95. You know. What's his slider like? You know, I mean, to me, holding a clipboard in the NFL is not the worst, you know, career move. You know, you stop taking the hits, and you get paid pretty well still. Not like you were getting paid.
I was going to say, like, Florio was sitting there talking about, what do you want to do, sit there and take $5 and $6 million for holding the clipboard? Yes, I'm fine with that. That'd be great. Thank you.
Now, of course, if you're a competitor, you know, of course, you want to start, you think you're good enough. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that Jameis Winston is absolutely talented enough. And at times, I mean, he you can go back last year, three, four, five monster games where you're like, whoa, the talent's never been in question. So, and I think he's a competitor. I'll be surprised if there's any sort of baseball pursuit here. I mean, he still has avenues to get himself back on the field. I really think, if Jacksonville's interested, that could be a place where it wouldn't take him long to surpass the Minshew magic as much as we like Gardner Minshew. And I think Winston could be like a Tannehill in this league if he gets the right opportunity. And just, you know, cuts down on the mind-numbing mistakes. Some of them just are hard to understand, but he's certainly good enough.
I think so, too. And look, I'll be honest with you. When you're comparing the two quarterbacks of Winston and Mariota, I think Winston's got a ton more upside than Mariota does. Now, you also know that with Mariota, you're not going to be throwing 30 picks in a season either. So if you're asking me the more likely one to have a comeback in the short term without knowing where Jameis Winston is and where he's going to end up, I do think Mariota has a good opportunity this year with Vegas to play. I think at some point he's probably going to get in there behind Derek Carr. It's hard to answer that question without knowing exactly where Winston's going to end up. But I do think purely from a talent standpoint, purely from a skill set standpoint, Winston is the more talented player in my mind.
Well, I think he's a more talented thrower, and I think the big difference in terms of upside is that, you know, Mariota's injury history gives you pause, and Winston hasn't had anything as serious as Mariota's had. So that, to me, is the difference. And I agree that Winston certainly is a better passer, just a pure passer. He has more arm talent than Mariota. Now, Mariota's deal is almost the opposite. You know, he doesn't take enough chances sometimes.
Right.
He doesn't let it rip sometimes, and Winston lets it rip. And you find a happy medium between both of them, and you might have yourself a good NFL quarterback.
It is interesting to see just what kind of a situation those two are in right now, being the number one and number two picks in the draft, and now here we are 5 years later, and both of them, their futures very much in question as we move forward here in the NFL. When we come back, our good friend Darren McFarland of Darren, Donick, and Chase will join us. We'll get his reaction to some of the moves the Titans have made in free agency. That's next. This is Morning Drive with Robbie Stanley and Joe Rexroad here on ESPN 105, The Game.